Well, hi there. You're listening to After Party Pod with your host, Anna David. Do you guys ever go through that, you know, you record your outgoing voicemail and you hate it, and then you record it again, and then you hate that, and so then you get in that endless spiral? So imagine what that's like. I'm resisting every temptation I have. Well, I'll admit it. This is the second time I've attempted to record this, and I didn't get very far in the first one. And I'm tempted because I have only said kind of nonsensical things so far to stop and start again, but I'm resisting that impulse. And I'll have you know, I have not changed my outgoing voicemail in years, so I don't know what my point is. But you are listening to After Party Pod. My name is Anna David. I'm an author, and I am the proprietress of the website After Party Chat, which I don't feel I've mentioned enough in this brief foray I've made into podcasting, but After Party Pod is a part of After Party Chat. You can see After Party Chat at afterpartychat.com, and it's all articles about addiction and recovery, but they're fun, and they're funny, and they're interesting, and it's sort of been my life mission to do this, and how I'd love to have you visit, you know? Anyway, this is the podcast. The song you just heard, that great jingle, was written by Seth Rothschild and performed by The Patience. You'll hear it again at the end of this, something to look forward to. And I would like to tell you about my guest today. Her name is Alexis Nyers. You can find her on Twitter at It's Alexis Nyers. Nyers is hard to spell. I only have guests whose last names are hard to spell. Prerequisite for coming on this podcast. It's N-E-I-E-R-S. Now, if you are familiar with Alexis, you may have had the same issue I did, which was I didn't know really any correct information about her. First of all, I thought it was pronounced Nyers. Could have fooled me that it was Nyers. And I became aware of her by seeing the movie The Bling Ring and knowing that Emma Watson played her. And I, after I saw the movie, and I remember when The Bling Ring, it feels like it happened just a minute ago, but I was in LA and I have a friend who was writing about it, and it was, you know, those kids who went and stole things from Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan, and it was this kind of fascinating story because the kids were all kind of seemed very glamorous and not much, you know, younger even than the stars there. Anyway, there was a lot in there, and then the movie came out, and there was not a lot in the movie, but it was like basically a almost like a live reenactment. There was no statement made, and it could say so much. Alexis actually talks about this in the interview, but I completely agree and said that when I saw the movie, that there is such an interesting statement in there about society today and what kids today value, and that their role models are these sort of empty celebrities. Not all of them are empty, but, you know, and it's all about acquiring and, you know, using things and fame to fill up these empty holes inside of us and all these things. None of that is in the movie. It's the closest thing I've ever seen to a live reenactment ever. But Alexis doesn't know that because she has not seen the movie. But anyway, somebody told me after I saw the movie, oh, you know, one of those girls is sober. Now, I'm a cynic because I live in this world today. And so when I hear someone sober, you know, in this era where every time a celebrity has a scandal, they go to rehab, you know, I sort of assume that that means I need to change my image more than I actually assume that means somebody's sober. Then I stumbled upon this piece that Alexis wrote for Vice, where she interviewed Dr. Gabor Mate, who's this amazing best-selling author of many books about addiction and trauma, and he's devoted his life to helping to solve the heroin epidemic in Vancouver. And in the story, she called herself a drug recovery nerd and wrote, "I couldn't give two fucks about going to dinner with Kim and Kanye, but I was dying to speak with Dr. Mate about how we could solve these issues," which that got my attention. So I started poking around for information and discovered that she really did seem very serious about her recovery, that she truly was a recovery nerd. and that she was married now and had a baby and was basically as far from the character Emma Watson played in The Bling Ring as I could imagine. Now, so I interviewed her. I met the husband and the baby, and I heard all about Pretty Wild, the reality show that she was in, and The Bling Ring, and Jail, and Lindsay Lohan, and yet she was nothing like I expected. I mean, she made fun of herself for how self-obsessed she was when she first got sober. She talked about how she never should have discussed being in jail with Lindsay Lohan, and she cried about her sister, not really her sister, but Tess, the girl that she, you know, was her best friend and lived with the family. Now, they may not make a TV show or movie about this new version of Alexis, but the line that she famously said in the Vanity Fair story, which Emma Watson said in the movie about how she wanted to change the world, just didn't, after I interviewed her, seem all that unlikely. She's pretty cool, guys. I hope you like this. And here is Alexis Nyers and me. Okay. So, Alexis. Hi.
Hi.
So, I was just telling you before I hit record that I just recently discovered you were sober. And it was surprising to me just because, you know, I just had seen the movie, mm-hmm. and I, you know, I remember it all seems like it happened really recently to me. Mm-hmm. It probably seems like it was
forever,
like another lifetime ago for you. And it was this great experience because I saw that you did this piece on Vice on Dr. Gabor Mate.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it, and it was really interesting, and I think I just, like, saw your name and clicked and did another click and suddenly got brought to your website where I put out this request, can I interview you, thinking, oh, I'll never hear back from this girl. and then I did, and here we are, and it was really only, you know, very recently.
Yeah.
So you have been sober for how long?
Let's see, almost 3 years, which it feels like it's no time at all, because sometimes it feels like it's been forever, and then sometimes it feels like it's been no time at all.
Right.
But when you get sober so young,
because you're 22 now, is that right?
Yeah, and I got sober when I was 19.
Right.
So it really, sometimes it feels like it's been really fast. Sometimes I'm like, wow, it's been a while. Because things change in your sobriety so much from, like, when you're newly sober to, like, get a couple years under your belt.
Yeah.
Things really change, and your perceptions continue to change, and it's crazy to me.
But your life has also changed more dramatically, I feel like, than most people's.
Yeah.
Like, you've done a lot of living in 22 years,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so you got sober and you met, like, your husband mm-hmm. through sobriety.
Yes.
How long were you sober then?
So I met him when I was brand spanking new, like, first. I was 10 days, let's see. So December 1st was my last arrest. 10 days later, I detoxed in jail, got sent to treatment.
And where did you go?
I went to the Sober Recovery Center uh-huh. in Malibu. And I met him at an AA meeting when I was, like, brand spanking new.
Right.
And I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy. Like, my shares were, like, just so full of ego, but, like, pain. And it
right.
was just destructive. And my biggest problem was that I got, like, best celebrity mugshot. And, like, my life was
and you
over.
Would share this
like,
stuff?
I would share this stuff.
Right,
because
right.
These were my problems that I thought were my problems.
Right.
Like, it was the court's problem. It
right.
was my old friend's problem. It wasn't my problem, though. Like, it was the media's problem.
And did people know who you were and what was
yes.
going on?
So my husband had no clue because he's Canadian. So
right.
he had just come down from Canada.
Right.
And he'd never seen the show. He'd heard about it because his best friend's wife used to, like, religiously watch it, I guess.
Right.
But he never looked me up or anything. And over a while, like, we started to become friends. I disappeared for a number of months. Like, literally went into hiding and just worked with my sponsor nonstop. Like, my life was dedicated to going to 3 AA meetings a day and working with my sponsor
Jesus.
Religiously. Well, I was in treatment, so I could do that.
Right.
You couldn't, if you had a normal life and you
right.
were trying to get sober, you couldn't. But I was in treatment for a year.
Wow.
So, I disappeared. And when I came back, all of a sudden I was like this new woman because I'd worked the 12 steps.
Right.
You know, I'd been doing, like, intensive therapy, trauma therapy, and we started developing a friendship, which, eventually led into a relationship in just a few months later, we were planning on getting married.
So you met him, and did he think you were nuts?
Oh, yeah.
So he was like, I'm staying away from that crazy girl.
Yes.
But then you guys became friends, you were going to the same meetings.
Well, I had that moment, those couple of months, it was like 4 months that I disappeared and like was really working hard on myself. And when I came back, he realized that like, wow, this is not, you know, they had like bets against me in Malibu AA that I would not stay sober. Right. Like, literally, they would, like, be betting each other. Like, this girl is just not going to make it. There's no way. Because I was distracted. I didn't want to take responsibility. Then, coming back, it was, like, all of a sudden I was, you know...
Sane,
sober. Healthy. I mean, obviously not 100% because I was only, like, 6 months sober then.
Right.
But I was in a much better place. Then we started, like, going to AA meetings together. He still kept his distance until I had about a year.
Nice.
And then he asked me out, and I was like, really? I don't know. And I was dating some other, like, Marine that was in AA who wasn't really sober.
First of all, there are Marines in AA.
There are Marines in AA, and it just was not working. We've been on a couple of dates, and I was like, maybe I'll give it a try. And our first date was, that was it. Like, I knew that I was...
Okay, so wait.
Meant to be with them forever.
Even though you'd been friends with him for a while, what was different on the date that hadn't been there when you
Something just clicked. Like, it wasn't a normal day. Like, we went to dinner at True Foods, and it was just, like, this instant... Like,
wait, I know what that is. That's out in Malibu.
Oh, it's, like, this place in Santa Monica. This, like, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free, everything. Right. And we were just sitting there, and it was, like, super romantic. And then we spent, like, hours and hours and hours together on the beach afterwards until, like, I don't know, 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. or something crazy like that. And I just knew, like, we were talking about our lives and our futures and what had happened. And he had been through so much. And, you know, he had, like, seven years at the time, so or six. And it just, I just knew.
Mm-hmm.
It just, like, the connection, the energy was, like, so intense that I knew. And it was kind of like a test because he was leaving for Canada, and I can't go to Canada because I have, like, a million felonies.
Right.
And so they don't let you into Canada.
Right.
And so I didn't know when he was coming back because he was going up for his visa. And I was like, okay, if I can do this, you know, like, if I can do this, like, we were meant to be together.
Right.
And I did. And
how long was he gone?
He was gone for, like, 6 months or so. And, like, it was so intense. And the thing that I realized in the beginning was I'm falling more in love with him while he's away. You know, like, I didn't need the physical relationship with him to fall deeper and deeper in love with him and who he was.
Right.
And then we got married, and here
we
are.
How long had you been dating when you got married?
We'd been dating for, like, 8 or 9 months.
Uh-huh. And then you got pregnant how long after getting married?
After we got married, let's see, so 4 months.
And then he opened the treat. He had opened the treatment center already.
The Sober Living. He opened the Sober Living. He opened Acadia, and that's initial. Like, we all, it was a hangout spot. Like, that's just the way that we are. Like, open door policy. We have barbecues. We're, like, all about sober fun.
Right.
And I used to hang out over there, and, like, that's kind of how the friendship started.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's go back. So, okay, how many felonies do you have, and what are they for?
Okay, I have 2 felonies on my record. The first was for residential burglary. Mm-hmm. The second was for possession of heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God, because it saved my life.
And so what happened when you got arrested that time? You sort of saw...
I don't know. You know, there's a number of things that, like, were divinely orchestrated to, like, get me to where I needed to be, in a place of, like, absolute, like, turmoil, and this is it.
Yeah.
So I had gone to jail before, but, you know, and kicked drugs, and, my life was, like, really in shambles because I was living this double life where people thought it was all, like, pretty and glamorous and television show. And then the other aspect was that I was literally living in a Best Western in Hollywood, like, shooting dope and smoking crack and smoking oxys. And my life was
horrible. Yeah, I read that. So while you were shooting the show,
Yes.
You were basically acting for the show.
Yes.
Even though it was a reality show.
Well, all reality, yeah.
Were, right, but more so than most reality shows. This
yes.
was. And so you would leave, and then you would go, like, by yourself with other,
no,
like,
no, no. So
friends?
I was smoking Oxys on set. Like, you are not going to get between an addict and their addiction and
right.
their drug of choice. So, like, wherever I went, drugs went.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I obviously had my a very codependent relationship with my sister Tess, and she's very open about the fact that we were using together.
And is she got sober, or?
She's doing really well now. She went through a really rough patch, and now, you know, she's off of her drugs of choice and has decided that she can just drink, and that's okay. And she moved to Wisconsin and started patching up her relationship with her mom, which is great because they had a really estranged relationship for,
right.
like, I think 10 years.
And this is Tess, who was your best friend, who your mom sort of basically adopted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, but I still actually want to go even further back. So how did you start using, and what, how old were you?
Okay, yeah. There was always escapes. Like,
yeah.
A lot of addicts and alcoholics say that. I had a lot of abuse when I was a young child. I had
right.
really bad sexual abuse, really bad physical abuse, emotional abuse, like, horrible codependent family,
right.
like, relationships. It was very intense. And
how old were you?
During the sexual abuse, 3 to 6 years old. Physical abuse, I don't know, I was, like, 10 to 12, like, but underlying all of this, there's, like, always emotional abuse.
And yeah.
I was just reading an article, actually, but that someone wrote for, oh, my God, I'm in a blank on the treatment center's name. They're, like, a huge trauma treatment center in, I think, Arizona, but...
Oh, the Meadows.
The Meadows.
Yeah.
You know, they say any experience that a child can perceive as traumatic, but then the adults in their lives don't comfort them can...
No.
create
yeah.
like post-traumatic
yeah.
yes terrible post-traumatic stress. So it was just really quite dysfunctional growing up. And
did you know that you'd been abused? Were you aware that it was abuse, that you
yeah,
were suffering?
So of course, like, the sexual abuse, I didn't know at the time that was abuse. I didn't even tell anybody until after I was 18 years old. I harbored that secret for a long time.
Right.
The physical abuse, I knew, like, that's not okay.
Right.
You know, and, like, the alcoholism, and as a child of an alcoholic addict, you know that when mommy or daddy is behaving that way, that's not normal. When you're going to friends' houses and their parents, mommy and daddies don't behave like that.
Right.
Don't drive them around drunk.
Right.
You know, don't try to race people on the freeway while it's extremely intoxicated.
Right.
Don't
right.
leave the house with, you know, a six-year-old in it by themselves to
right.
get drunk. Like,
right.
you know that behavior is not okay. And then you've got, like, a mom who's doing her best, but that's telling you, like, daddy smokes pot and daddy does this and daddy does that. And it just, you know, it makes it, you know, when a child doesn't have an outlet to, like, express themselves or to feel comfortable sharing these things, like, it just becomes worse. So my first drink was, like, in, I think, 5th or 6th grade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, drinking was never really my thing. Like, I pretty much went straight to drugs.
Right, right,
like,
right.
Drugs where they were readily available.
What drugs?
Started with pot, and then I had, like, a little pill phase. Then I went into, like, I was prescribed a lot of medications, too, from a young age, because my mom didn't know what to do with me. So she's, like, obviously she's depressed, and she's got anxiety, and she's got ADHD. So it was so many drugs. I mean, then I had hit an acid stage, and then I was taking 2CB and 2CI, and then all the, you know, all
What's
these
that?
Like,
I don't even know what that is.
They're, like, crazy, like, hallucinogenic. Like, it's like MDMA mixed with acid. It's just terrible. Like, I would take anything and everything.
Well, and then they sort of made a big deal about how on the show your mom would be like, oh, do you want an Adderall right now?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, my mom, like, you know, God bless her, she did not know that, you know, if a doctor's prescribing you something,
well,
she
I think
didn't
there are a
know.
Lot of people out there that are like that.
Yes, and people, I can't tell you how many people have come to me and said, my doctor prescribed me benzos. I've been on benzos for, like, 6 years now, and I can't get off them. And the amount that I take is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And nobody tells you these are extremely addictive. You grow dependency. You're going to have to take more and more until you deal with the underlying issue. You're going to basically become addicted to a substance.
Right.
And you can't get off them because you could have, you know, seizures.
Right.
With benzos. So you're going to have to go to a medical detox. It's going to be extremely painful. Nobody tells you these things.
I wonder if now that it's out there, I mean, certainly in my day, I mean, I remember getting, I had migraines and I was prescribed hardcore opiates that aren't even on the market anymore. They were so dangerous. And they just, and I would build up a tolerance because I would take it every day.
Yeah.
And then they would just give me a stronger one and then a stronger one. But, like, I do, I mean, and the thing with opiates, obviously, is that kids will get addicted and then they can't get them anymore. And so it's easier to get heroin than a lot of prescriptions.
Yeah. And my whole thing now, especially, you know, like we were talking about Gabor Mate before, is like, but why the opiates in the first place?
Right.
You know, and I really had to take a look at that. Like, I used because of the trauma that occurred in my life. And, you know, and I agree with him that the genetic predisposition for, you know, this disease, as we'll call it, is not the biggest contributing factor. The biggest contributing factor is trauma that occurs in early childhood.
But there are addicts who didn't suffer any trauma.
That's true. That's true. These days, though, especially with my generation, I feel like that's really far and few between. Like, it with my generation, and my last piece that I wrote with Bob was, like, all about...
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Oh,
okay.
It's all about, like, my generation and why, you know, it's like the baby boomers, they always are talking about how my generation is just, like, this, like, damn generation because we have Facebook and internet and Instagram on our cell phones, and it's just not the case. It's just not the case. The truth of the matter is that, like, the majority of our parents, they were in this, they had these belief systems that, like, if I love my child enough and I befriended my child enough that they would turn out okay.
Right.
And in turn, like, we were never taught, like, many life skills or, you know, and we look at, like, why the majority of my generation is, like, on unemployment, can't seem to get a job, moves back into home after college, why is this happening? And there's, like, so many of us, I think it's, like, 70% of Americans are now on some sort of drug.
Right. Well, there's a difference also between the types of drugs that people can be on. I mean, there's SSRIs, which are not addictive. But, you know, I mean, I do think that's true. My generation was very much, like, our parents were not, like, all loving and supportive. They were more like, you know what, you're not good enough and all this stuff. That was totally traumatic.
Yes.
But at least we came up in the world and we sort of felt like we had to prove ourselves because we were never told we were enough. But
part of that trauma then translate into like you trying to parent your children polar opposite.
Right, which creates more trauma.
Which creates more trauma too. Because if you're allowing your kids to smoke pot and drink and have sex and you know, you're like you're being more of a friend than you are, like, you know, I believe, you know, as parents, obviously you're supposed to love your children and provide, like, a safe, loving environment for them, but you're also supposed to teach them life skills and boundaries and how to be successful. And for me, it's like I didn't have self-esteem.
Right.
And it's a direct result of the fact that, like, I was never forced to do esteemable acts.
Right.
I just thought if my mom loved me enough and we did enough vision boards that, like, we would be okay.
But I read that it wasn't really the secret. You weren't really raised on The Secret. That you just did that in the movie.
No. Okay, so we were raised on Ernest Holmes' philosophy of the science of mind, which is, like, this really, like, you know, new age thought. And it has been in my family. I mean, we've been practicing, like, Ernest Holmes and reading a lot of Ernest Holmes and been very spiritual for generations and generations. And
on your mom's side of the family.
On my mom's side of the family. And my mom raised us. My dad wasn't really in the picture for the most part. So, this, you know, The Secret was, like, this new thing. It's funny because growing up, I was really, I felt ostracized by the community. Like, you're weird. You have life-size Buddhas in your house. Like, you're, like, your family's off-limit. Like, you're not Christian. You're not Jewish. You don't go to church. You don't go to temple. You're not having a bar mitzvah. Your family's, like, really hippy-dippy. And parents, like, would not let their kids come and hang out with my mom because she was, like, very spiritual and, like, lit sage through the house every day and stuff. And nowadays, like, everybody can't get enough green tea and yoga. And it's funny because it's totally changed. And now it's, like, become this, like, huge, cool thing.
She was just ahead of her time.
She was. You know, she's always been very spiritual. And I think she's always sought relief in, you know, alternative therapy and alternative medicine. And it works for her. And a lot of it works for me, too, today.
Right.
Some of it doesn't, but a lot of it does.
Right. I mean, who knows if that's what sort of saved you. You know what I mean? That gave you the, you know, whatever it was that got you to the point where, you know, because a lot of people don't survive the kind of trauma that you're talking about. They don't come out on the other side.
True.
But I was going to say about the self-esteem, I mean, don't you think that part of it, too, was like all the, I mean, and I don't know how much has been exaggerated or was for show, but like the fabulosity of all of that. Didn't you think you got esteem from?
But that's fake self-esteem.
Right,
that's
but at the time, you didn't, did you know that?
But, you know, when you're harboring that many secrets and you're that much pain, like, that's all ego. Like, that is not, you know, that is not real. That is not something that, like, you know, self-esteem to me today is, like, an awareness of who I am, my place in the world, you know, and having confidence in myself that I can achieve anything that I want to achieve and that I am able to do so.
Right.
Back then, it was like, this man's going to take care of me and I'm just going to make money doing it like this for a while to have fun. Like, it wasn't sustainable. Like, it was
right, but did you know
false.
That then?
Oh, I knew. I knew that it was, I knew because I was still in the amount of pain that I was in.
Right.
Like, I had everything that I wanted, you know, like, at my feet, but the only thing that I wanted was to get high.
Right.
Like,
I
could have had anything. I could have done anything. And all I wanted to do was get loaded. And so the amount of pain that I was in, there weren't enough drugs to soothe it. Like, there wasn't enough heroin or coke or drinking or whatever it was for me. I think that the reason why I ended up falling in love with opiates as much as I did was because, you know, when you're nodding out, like, everything's gone.
Yeah.
Everything's gone. But I couldn't nod out enough. That's the problem. Is that, like, I couldn't be in that state enough. And I'm surprised that I wasn't, you know, a heavier drinker because, you know, or like a blackout drinker. It was like opiates were the thing for me. And, you know, and it was like a love affair. Like, they were my everything.
And so, okay, and so basically what I do want to like sort of get what was real and what has been like exaggerated. So, so you were living out kind of in this area, like outside of LA, but you and Tess were like starting modeling careers. You decide, like, you, people had come to you, you decided to pursue it and your mom was super all for it.
Yeah.
And you met, a producer who was like, I have this idea. Let's do a reality show about how glamorous your lives are, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were fun and glamorous at the time.
Right.
You know, it's like, Tess and I got into that industry because, well, first of all, Tess didn't even graduate high school. Like, what was she going to do? She didn't want to go back to school. Like, we were pretty much already using heavily. So, you know, school's not, like, in the picture. I think Tess got kicked out of the last school because she took too much Ambien, started hallucinating, and called, I don't know. It was just really bad. She wasn't going to stay in school. And I had graduated 2 years early. And so we were already using substances, and we decided that modeling, because everybody told us, like, oh, you should try modeling. Like, you should try, you know, like, your family's kind of been in the industry, because my dad was in the industry for a long time. My stepdad was, like...
What did they do?
My dad was the director of photography on Friends for, like, 8 years, the nanny, Spin City, and my stepdad is a set designer, so he does sets for, I mean, right now, like, Charlie Sheen's show and stuff like that. And so they were like, why don't you just try acting and try modeling? It's great money, and you can have fun while doing it, and... I think my mom just kind of wanted us to do something. Like, laying around and sitting in Westlake Village and getting high with your friends is, like, come on, do something. Like, you're getting to be adults now. And so it got her offer back.
Uh-huh.
And it, you know, we were just doing these, like, small odd jobs, like Marilyn Manson music videos and, like, really weird things to sustain our habit. Like, we'd make a couple hundred bucks a day.
Right.
You know, get your drugs and, like, on to the next one.
And how did you guys meet? You and Tess?
Tess? I've known Tess since I was 3. Mm-hmm. So we met in, like, our parents met because we were in the same ballet class.
Mm-hmm.
And they became friends right away.
And then that family moved to Wisconsin or whatever? Or?
No. So Tracy was Tessa's mom, and she had always struggled with, you know, her own demons and stuff. And so Frank, Tessa's dad, took full custody, and so Tess was kind of, like, in and out of our lives. My mom's always been, like, a mother figure to Tess.
Right.
And then Tracy got, I don't know, into, like, some trouble and, like, moved with her boyfriend to Wisconsin, and then Tess didn't talk to her for, like, I think, like, 8 or 10 years or something like that. Frank still lives out here.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's been in and out of our lives since I was 3.
Right. So, okay, and then how would you guys get cast in, like, the Marilyn Manson video? You would just, like, find out about these things? Were people sending you out?
We would just do, like, we'd go on, we'd have, you know, MySpace back then was, like, big.
Right.
And, we joined, like, LA casting website, mm-hmm. and, you know, we just go out on, like, random auditions and, you know, do photo shoots with people and stuff like that, and all of a sudden it, you know, started progressing, and Tess was doing Playboy at the time, and so she's, like, dating rock stars, and life was fun, life was glamorous,
right.
Like, we weren't, you know, like, we were, like, or I shouldn't say we, like, I was already smoking Oxys at that point, but I wasn't, it wasn't to the point, like, where I wasn't functioning. Like,
right.
I was having fun functioning and,
right.
you know, and it was great until it wasn't so great anymore.
Right. And so, okay, and so you met, like, okay, so you would go to, like, Les Deux. Is that sort of that era?
Yeah. So, you know, as we started working these jobs, we'd meet, like, oh, I'm a club promoter. You should come to this club, and this is the hot night, and this thing, and we'd never really, like, been clubbing before by any means. I was so young. I was, like, 17.
Well, and it's a long drive from this area to a club in Hollywood.
Yeah, well, they were sending us limos to pick us
up,
and, you know, and so we would be, like, the arm candy, and before you know it, it's, like, we're out every night, and we're hanging out with this, you know, rich and famous of L.A., and... Yes, and then we met the producer when we were filming this silly movie Frat Party that was, like, a low-budget Showtime flick. And he was like, you girls are great. And we totally lied. Like, we had this whole thing, like, where we were fraternal twins. We were 20 years old, so that way no one would ever want to ID us because we weren't 21.
Right.
And so everyone would have to pay the bouncers for us to go into the clubs. And,
wait, what do you mean? So because you weren't 21, they'd pay them off, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, like, I didn't ever need an ID, so because we were, like, 20 years old.
Right, and that's how you could pass it off that you were sisters.
So we were, like, fraternal. We had this whole thing going, and people just, like, loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
No doubt.
And, you know, we are a good time. Like, if you want to have fun and party, we are the girls to do it. Like, we don't stop. Like, we will party until 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 3 days, doesn't matter.
Right. So you would go out, like, the limo would come out here at, like, 9 o'clock or whatever, and then you would just go to Les Deux, and then it was after parties and wherever else.
Yes.
And so what about, like, and so then connecting with those other kids and the robberies and all of that?
Well, we only knew one other kid. Well, Tess knew a few others just because they lived in the area, but we never, like, associated with them or, like, were friends with them before all this took place. And so Tess knew Nick. Nobody really, like, I never went to school with these kids. Everybody says I went to school with these kids. I never went to school with these kids.
Right.
I met this kid, and 3 months later, he was taking me to a house and he robbed a house. Like,
right.
Literally in a 3 month time of knowing this person. I didn't know him beforehand.
Right.
He'd been robbing houses for like years and years before that.
Right, right.
So he was like this stylist guy and he was young and gay and fabulous and he was dressing us in all these fabulous clothes.
I never said he was gay in the movie.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, but like it was kind of clear.
Come on.
I know.
He was like wearing Paris Hilton shoes or whatever.
Right.
I didn't see the movie, but like.
Are you tempted or no?
You know, I really feel like I was hoping, you know, because Sophia was doing the movie, that it would really have this, like, strong impact and talk about, like, our society today and this culture of more, 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 and, like, really talk about, like, our obsession with fame and celebrity and getting in it. Because, like, the story of The Bling Ring is a pretty boring story. Like, if it was not celebrity houses, nobody would give a damn. But because it was, and we have this culture of, like, where you can click a button on your phone and figure out what's going on in anybody's lives, and people want, they idolize. They no longer idolize, like, spirituality and stuff.
Right.
They idolize fame and fortune and celebrity. And so, you know, The Bling Ring gave them an inside look into these people's, like, up-close and personal lives. And so if she could have done, like, a really intense, great movie about that, I would be like, yes, I'm going to go see that movie. But to go and pay, like, what is it, like, $14 now to sit in a theater and watch some movie about, like, the glamorous lifestyle of these kids robbing houses,
okay,
to me...
Okay, but that there's a character that is you that doesn't tempt you?
No. Not really. I mean, if it, when it comes out on Netflix or something, I'll watch it. But, like, I have a little baby now. Like, my life is not... I don't think people understand that. Like, my life is not Bling Ring. Like, my life is a story, is a young girl who is, like, broken and in so much pain. And her life was in shambles. And somehow, in a period of 3 years, she has healed from it, gone to school, become a counselor, works with women now, is, like, relatable on so many levels to helping people, and is now, like, a wife and a sponsor and a daughter
and
a friend and a mother, and, like, that's my life today. So you want to do a, it's like my, you know, I put it so perfectly in another interview, it's like, if you did a movie about Sofia Coppola's life and the only thing that you put in it was how she ruined the Godfather franchise, it wouldn't be a fair movie, right? Like, if you just talked about the fact that she was famous for being famous in her 20s and, like, she ruined the Godfather franchise. Like, and you just did a movie, you cut it off there, and you didn't talk about any of her successes later.
Right.
Would it be an impactful movie? No. It's like...
No.
Come on.
No. I mean, by the way, I wouldn't be here if I didn't know all, like, if I didn't believe all of that about you. I do think it's remarkable. And, like, and I do, I mean, it's kind of interesting because we were talking before I started recording about how you're really good at ignoring just sort of, like, hostile, anonymous people on the internet.
Yeah.
And I'm decent at it, but, like, I bet you've had to really, did you have to learn that or you just knew?
To be honest, like, these days, especially since I've been sober, the majority of people that write me are all support.
Yeah.
Like, you've, like, I just did a radio interview, and people called in, and this one woman's like, I'm a mother of a 10-month-old, and I was a heroin addict, and I only got sober because of you.
Wow.
Like, those are the types of calls that I get. Or this, you know, other girl that said, like, I was going to commit suicide, but then I saw your Twitter and your blog, and, you know, I feel like there's hope for me now. Those are the types of people that write me these days.
Right.
Now, of course, there's, like, the haters and, like, the trolls who I believe are addicted to hating. Like, you can be addicted to hate. Like, honestly, if you're a hater.
Yeah.
I used to listen to that song, Haterade. Did you ever listen to it?
No.
Like, I'm sipping on that Haterade. It's with, like, Nicki Minaj and stuff. Okay,
yeah.
So, like, that was, like, my theme song. And now it's just, like, you can literally get, like, people get a rush out of it. It's like,
well,
yes.
I think it, like, makes them feel powerful. I mean, like,
yes.
To me, I feel like anybody who does that, who spends their life commenting, you know, I mean, and, like, below the belt, people, it's like they probably suffered trauma too.
A lot.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they don't know how. They have never had therapy. They don't have the 12 steps. They don't have tools.
Yes.
And so they think they get triggered by someone who they see as doing stuff when they're not doing anything. And that, and that rage that they felt towards whoever traumatized them gets expressed towards X random person.
And it really is sad. And, it really, and in, It's sad. It's really sad. And so, you know, the majority of the time I just write it off. I'm just like, whatever. Like, you're going to just have your belief system. So I'm not here to change people's belief systems. I'm here to help people change if they want to change.
Right.
But, like, if you want to be wrapped up in your toxicity of
your situation. Right. It's just too bad because it doesn't, they think it makes them feel better, you know? I know. And I get it, by the way. I had this, when I first started, like, blogging or something, I wrote about meeting some writer. It was before I'd published a book. I wrote about meeting some writer at a party and that he was rude to me. Mm-hmm. And it was his book party. And the writer clearly had a Google alert about himself. This was before I knew about these things. Mm-hmm. And he commented on my blog that no one read. And he said, it was my book party for my first book. I was really, really suffering, like, major social anxiety. I'm sorry if you felt I was rude.
Oh, wow.
And it completely changed. And I just sort of made that decision that I'm never going to write anything negative about anybody.
Yeah.
Ever again. Sometimes if it's, like, I'm sort of joking about someone who's, like, so super famous, they're never going to hear it, whatever, that's different. But I will not. Because, and then I've read mean things about myself that I know are not about me.
I have to be careful. Like, back, one of my biggest regrets, and I wrote about this when I was interviewed by Vice before I started writing for them, was I did this interview about Lindsay Lohan, about her in jail, because we were in jail together or whatever. And I did it for the money, because I needed the money.
Like,
I just got out of jail. I need to support my drug habit. Like, I'm sure she would understand. Okay,
so
now she's in treatment, and I've seen her around, and she came up to me in a meeting. She had no idea who I was. She was, like, looking at the baby, and I was like, oh, my God, this is your moment. This is your moment. But then I was like, I don't want to do this in a meeting. But it made what it did was it made me feel just so horrible, because I have to realize, like you were saying, like, you don't know what people are going through. And so we can make just small comments, like, you know, someone from my past wrote me, and I said, I hope you're doing well, and I hope you're healing. My husband pointed out to me, well, you're insinuating that he's, like, not doing well and that he's not healing.
Right.
And so we just have to be so careful, because you just don't know what people are going through. And, you know, and just one little thing can really send somebody off the edge. And so was it my place to go and be speaking about Lindsay Lohan or her reaction to jail and crying in jail? Of course she was crying. She's in jail.
Right. You were crying too, I bet.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's a freaking mess. So, you know, it certainly wasn't my place, and I, you know, if I could take it back, I totally would, but you just never know what someone's going through.
Yeah, and I do think you have to sometimes learn the lesson that way, by doing it and feeling how bad it feels.
Yes.
And knowing that, you know,
well, if you have any sort of a conscience, you know, like, I should not have done that.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that, I mean, I think the truth is, I think with all that stuff, it's just remembering that, like, we're all sick in our own way. Mm-hmm. And so that person who's just spewing negativity on the internet, Lindsay Lohan, the person from your past, whoever it is, the guy I wrote that was rude to me at the party, me, you know, that and so that helps it to be, you know, to come from a compassionate place and to go, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. And we're all making mistakes, but we're trying. You know, some of us are trying. But, I mean, I believe everyone is doing the best they can.
Everybody is. And that was another thing that I had to realize, like, when, you know, becoming a sponsor and stuff, is, like, I don't know what these people are going through. Like, I'm here to help you if you want help and to take you through the steps. I'm not here to have opinions about your life or to tell you what to do or who to date or anything like that. I'm here to help you. Like, I'm not the relationship police. I'm not here to police your life and tell you who to hang out with and how many meetings to go to. Like, I'm here to listen to you. And I had, like, a big moment of clarity where it was, like, I realized if my sponsor didn't have those, like, deep listening skills to listen to what I was saying and to not have any opinion about it, I wouldn't be sober.
Right.
Because that's all I needed. And I think that people, like, lose that. They don't realize that that's what AA was all about in the beginning. It was just two alcoholics talking to each other. And that's one of the greatest things that I've learned from Bob, you know, is that when people are on their deathbeds, they didn't talk. He says, like, when people are on their deathbeds, which he's, I guess,
been there
a number of times with, I think he's got like 18, 19 years or something. They never talked about the fact that they could have made more money or whatever. They talked about the fact that they could have had better relationships with people.
Right.
And I think that people don't, they forget that. Like, they become so religious about this book. That book was made to reach people who couldn't get to a meeting. Now that there's this many meetings in the world, like, it's about the relationships that you build and the communication that you have with people and really saying to someone, like, I understand you.
Right.
And I love you.
Right.
And I care for you. Those are things that I had never really heard.
Right.
Before getting sober.
Right, right. Me neither.
And so having that experience is, like, so vital. I think so many people get wrapped up in, like, this, you know, I call it, like, Nazi-type sponsoring.
Right.
It's just ineffective. Like, it just turns people off of the program. Like, you need to, like, all of a sudden you're becoming someone's doctor and telling them you need to be on this medication and that medication and you need to get off your medications. I personally did, but that was my choice. I'm not going to tell a sponsee, like, you can't be on antidepressants. Like, you know, the Pacific Group is great, you know, but it just, that's dangerous.
I had that with a woman who was sponsoring me, and she was PG. Mm-hmm. And she, because my first sponsor went out when I had a year. She's actually back, and we're good friends now. But I had this woman, and I remember I was doing step work in her car outside a meeting, and I said something about medication. And she was like, you're on medication? And I said, yeah, I'm taking an SSRI. And she's like, you're not sober. Get out of my car. That is an experience that happened to me, you know? And luckily, you know, I was sober enough to realize that it was her ignorance that was ruling her at that moment. But no, I mean, the problem is, of course, that there's no training for sponsoring. Yes. The other problem is that oftentimes the new people are attracted to the sickest people in the rooms because that's who they relate to the most. And oftentimes the sickest people are the ones that are going to corner the new people. Yes. So, and it is not a perfect situation. No.
And I think that it's lost that I think it's lost its roots. Like, it really has. Like, I think that, you know, one of the questions that I had that I don't think I published for the Vice article is this whole controversial thing about using Ibogaine and ayahuasca to treat heroin addicts and alcoholics, like severe heroin addicts. And Dr. Gabor Mate is a big fan of it. He uses it. And it's like, there's just so many different alternative methods and people, but the biggest thing is, like, the healing is healing from the trauma. And I don't care how you get your healing.
Right.
What I care about is that you're getting it.
Right.
And I feel like it's my job as a sponsor to do my best to help you accomplish that. And it's like the steps were written to just be a guide, and, like, we're not supposed to do much more than that. Like, I'm supposed to take you through the steps and really listen to you.
Right.
And that's it. If you need therapy, you've got to go to a therapist. If you need medication, you've got to go to a psychiatrist. I'm not.
Right.
You know, and it's hard because in the beginning, I had such strong opinions about medications like Suboxone.
Yeah.
I didn't get sober on Suboxone. I kicked cold turkey.
Right.
Because I was in jail. You know, but this whole, like, Suboxone maintenance, like, be on Suboxone for a year, in the beginning.
Or be on Suboxone for life.
For life. You know, 36 milligrams of Suboxone every day. It's like, you're high.
Yeah, do you not have that opinion anymore?
Well, I have a little bit more of a spiritual approach to it now, which is, like, if your spirit is ready, you know, it's much better to be on Suboxone than it is to be, like, slamming heroin, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Obviously, for a number of reasons, health reasons, the fact that it doesn't spread, you know, dirty needles and things like that. Obviously, it's much better to be on Suboxone than it is if you're not ready to get, like, really sober and do the work. You know, it's such a touchy issue. Like, it's, I have mixed opinions about it. And, you know, now with, like, the Vivitrol shot, like, that's always a great option, you know, if you, you know, really want to try this, but you're a chronic relapser, you know. But the thing is, like, the reason why you're a chronic relapser and the reason why you use drugs is because your life is painful.
Right.
Too painful to deal in the world. And so if you could give yourself, buy yourself enough time, or just allow yourself to have enough time to let the healing begin.
Do you think the healing can happen if you're on Suboxone?
I feel like it's kind of spiritual bypass is what
right,
I call it.
Right,
like,
right.
In order to grow, in my experience, in order for me to grow and to develop into the person that I am today, I had to be medication free and I had to be willing, desperate and willing enough
right.
to walk through my past
right.
to address it and to be courageous enough to like heal.
And
I couldn't have done that myself being on any medication because I had been on antidepressants for years
mm-hmm.
and Adderall for years, anti-anxiety medication for years. I couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was making me insane. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if people should be on Zoloft for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of like...
Well, it's hard to know if you're mixing it with
me,
a lot of other drugs
yes,
and drinking.
But for me, it was like I couldn't. When I first got sober, they put me on Effexor and Wellbutrin together.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't do it. Like, I really needed to heal. Like, have weeks of crying and pain and just what seemed back then like suffering, but now seems like liberation. Like, I really needed that myself.
And you needed therapy, I'm assuming.
Yes. So I did like a lot of, I did EMDR,
yeah,
which was great
yeah.
for post-traumatic stress, especially for the sexual abuse and trauma.
Yeah.
Needed the EMDR. But like while I was in treatment, I was only asked maybe a handful of times if, that have you, what was the trauma that you experienced in your childhood? And I think that that's a major missing link. And I felt like there was a lot of judgment, and it was kind of like a pissing contest. And
was it dealt with
just,
in group?
I did a lot of group therapy,
yeah.
and then I did a lot of one-on-one therapy too. But I just really needed someone to say, like, you don't have to change for me. You know, and that I love you even if you do decide that you want to continue to use it. I didn't, what I needed was for people to stop shaming, blaming me and telling me you're a junkie,
yeah.
get your shit together,
yeah.
you have a terrible life, you're going to kill yourself.
Or you're a bad person.
You're a bad person. What are the choices that you're making? Well, it's not a matter of choice. It tells me right,
right
in the big book, like
right.
I think on page 24, 26, like, it's not a matter of choice. Like the alcoholic will always choose to drink or use
right.
like you're without defense against the first drink
right.
like there's it's not a matter of choice in my head like I'm gonna be a good person I'm gonna be a bad person
right, right.
It's like no I'm gonna do whatever it takes to not feel the way that I'm feeling anymore
right right right
and I need that's what I needed like in treatment I needed that from my family to say like you don't have to change for me and when I was dealing with my sister Tess she was in a really just had gotten really bad. And I contacted Bob and I said, Bob, what do I do? I want to do an intervention. I got a call. She seems like she's like dying, I guess. That's what somebody had told me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go do an intervention. I've got my private investigator following her. I've got her dad. Yes.
Okay.
I've got her dad ready to like jump in and take action. Like
right.
we're in a swarmer house, 7 a.m. Like, and he was like, "This is an ambush. This is
right.
not." But you see that on like intervention and
right.
A&E shows and stuff
right,
like that.
Right,
like
right.
that's how interventions in my eyes
right.
look.
Right.
And he was like, "Why don't you just ask her if you could take her to breakfast?" And I said, "Are you kidding?" And he was like, "No, I'm serious. You need to go into this not expecting her to change for you."
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, I owe her the biggest amends ever. Like, it just clicked. Like, I need to love her because I know the beautiful little ballerina, princess,
right.
baby
three-year-old.
Girl, angel
yeah.
that she is. And not be ashamed or embarrassed if somebody comes in with track marks, 80 pounds, looks totally different than who
right.
I know this person to be. I needed to go into that situation and make an amends to her for trying to force her to change that way I'd be okay with myself.
Right, right.
And I did just that. My husband and myself and Bob took her to breakfast. And I gave her a hug and I made an amends to her that was like, so beautiful. It was my best amends yet. And she looked at me and she said, I'm not ready. Mm. And I said, that's okay. Why don't you call me next week and we'll go to coffee? And, and I hugged her and I let her go on her way. And I waited patiently and Bob's like, just wait. It'll be a few weeks or a few months. She will call you when she's ready. She now knows that she has a person that she can call, that she can rely upon, that she can trust, that loves her no matter what.
Right.
And when she's ready, you will be the person that she calls. And what do you know? It was only a matter of weeks. But she needed to go and continue to have her experience. The moment of clarity that happens for every addict and alcoholic that gets sober, that moment, that bottom, whatever you want to call it, is so personal.
Yeah.
And it can't be created
no.
by anybody else. It's a moment that just happens. It's very spiritual. It's very sacred. It's very special. And it can't be created by anybody else. And I need to wait to let her have her own moment. And she did. She did.
That's amazing.
And now she's doing her own thing. She's doing outpatient. And who cares if she thinks she could still drink a glass of red wine? Not my fucking problem.
Right,
excuse me.
Right, right.
Not my, I can't have opinions about it anymore. I've got to let her do what works best for her. At least she's like on a path.
Right.
That's not of like complete self-destruction and suffering.
Right, right. And how are you guys in touch all the time?
Yeah, I mean, we text on a regular basis. You know, and she loves her life out there. She loves, I mean, clearly, like, she's loving the quiet life of living in Wisconsin, which is great. Like, if that's what you want to do, she's got, like, a boyfriend now who, like, is not some, like, L.A. guy. Like,
right, right.
And if that works for her, then great.
Right. I mean, you guys have both kind of gone 180 degrees from where you were.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, life is all, you know, the only thing that I know for sure is that life always changes.
Yeah.
You know, everything else I don't really know. And that my goal on this planet in this lifetime is to evolve and to change and to grow. And to deepen like my spirituality, which is like my spirit, my connection to this universe, to this world, to my higher power. That is the only thing that I'm, you know, it's like that step 11 and 12, that's my life today.
Well, and interestingly, it was what you were sort of raised to believe anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
the funny thing is that I had tried it all. Like, I had gone and stayed at ashrams and prayed with monks and, you know, tried to be a Christian, then Jewish, then Catholic. Like, I had tried it all, and I didn't realize that, you know, that it's a combination of things. It's, like, first relieving yourself of the trauma.
Right.
And, you know, the steps are in an order for a reason, and then I decided to deepen,
right,
you know, and that work with the assistance of therapy and support groups. And then, you know, because when I first got sober, it wasn't just drugs and alcohol. Like, I had an eating disorder, I had all the trauma, so like I had to deal with
dual diagnosis.
Yes.
Situation.
Yeah. And I needed to like tackle all of these things pretty much at once. I was still dealing with my eating disorder up until
what was it?
So I was just like a binge eater. Like, I would eat, and then I would starve.
Right.
And like, it got to a point, actually, when I first started dating Evan, where he said, like, I love you, but you need to go talk to somebody about this, because I was just way too thin.
Right.
Way too thin.
How much did you weigh?
Unhealthy. Like, 108 pounds, and I'm 5'7" almost.
Right.
Like,
right.
Way too thin. Like, my clothes are falling off of me, and I'm not eating. And I even asked him this question. I was like, do vitamins have calories? Like, right. That's where my head was. Like, and for me, it was like another escape, and that was another thing that I had to deal with. That was like after I had a year.
Right.
Sober. So, there's a lot of things.
And and then and you went back to school because I'm doing my KDAC right now. Is that what you
yes.
did?
Yes. So I did a program through. You're familiar with sober college, right?
No, actually.
Okay,
what
so
is that?
Sober college is. It's like a rehab. They do long-term care. They offer classes and stuff like that they really help people get back on their feet. And so they offered the KDAC program through the Institute of Chemical Dependency Studies. So they had a teacher from Channel Island State come and teach a six-month course. I still haven't done my practicum hours because then I got married and had a baby.
Right.
I really want to do my practicum hours. It's more because your program's 2-year, right?
Yeah. I was like, six months. What are you talking about?
It's like an intensive six-month program.
So you're in school full-time.
Do, a lot of it's work at home. It's a lot of, like,
right.
you know, like, papers and effort and field work and stuff like that. But it's, how many intern hours do you have to do?
I don't know. I've only done a year, and it's been exhausting. I can't even believe how much work it's been. If I'd known, because I don't even have plans to become a counselor.
Yes.
I'm doing it for quote unquote
fun. That's what I did too.
And I'm like,
I wanted to learn about the disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've learned a ton, but it is so much work. I can't believe that there's an internship, and then. I have to take the test. I mean, like, that's not even within the realm of what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I might not ever take it, you know?
I don't know if I will either.
Yeah.
But you know what? I loved the experience. Greg Hanley, the owner of SOBA, basically said, you're going to go to school while you're here.
Because that's where you went to treatment, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thank God he did, because it, like, basically saved me, because I was learning so much about myself
yeah.
and so much about the disease, and I was like brand spanking new, like a month sober, and he was like, you're going to enroll in this.
Right.
And I was like, okay, great. And so I was doing so much, like between treatment and groups and therapy and 12 steps and AA meetings and school, like I was like recovery.
Right.
Was I ate
it was all
three.
You did
it was
yeah.
all I did.
Yeah. It's intense. And then getting pregnant in terms of the eating disorder, that trigger?
No, so I'd done a lot of, you know, healing before I got pregnant.
Yeah.
From, like, the eating disorder stuff. I mean, it's typical that we cross addict and that we become obsessive about other things.
Of course.
Obviously, I was on a good track already, and so I just needed a little bit more support. And
right.
I needed to address this, you know, body dysmorphia that I was dealing with that
right.
I still deal with today.
Right.
I don't believe my eating disorder will probably ever go away.
Right.
The good thing is that today I'm able to be so aware and so connected to myself and my feelings and where I'm at. And it's like constantly checking in. You know, with my daughter, I gained like 50 pounds.
Right.
While I was pregnant, which is, like, a lot of weight. They say you should gain, like, for my height and weight, like, 35 to 45 pounds. I gained, like, 50 pounds or something like that. So it wasn't an issue. It's an issue now.
Right.
I'm, like, kind of obsessive over it. I keep trying to check in, reminding myself to go slow. Like, I'm
right.
doing lots of hot yoga and walking and
right.
making sure that I'm eating enough calories. I don't own a scale.
Right. Yeah. I don't either.
I just want to go back to feeling healthy and like myself.
Right.
And it's definitely a challenge. I think it's a challenge for every woman, though. Like, okay, you all of a sudden you have this baby. Your hair starts falling out. Your skin starts breaking out. You're like 20 pounds heavier than you were
right.
before you had the baby. It's the hardest 20 pounds to get off because your body, when you're breastfeeding, says you need to keep eating and
yeah.
producing more milk. Like, there's so much going on. Plus, you're taking care of a newborn. You haven't slept in 3 months.
right.
So it's a lot, you know, and connecting. I really wanted to start a mommy group for, like, women in recovery, some sort of recovery. I don't care if you're in NA, AA, Al-Anon. I wanted to create a group for young moms because we all need support. I mean, moms with young children.
Right.
Because we all need support. And we can't make it to meetings because you've got a screaming baby that's attached to your hip. Like, I'm exclusively breastfeeding. So, like,
right.
to take her to a meeting is...
But you could all take the babies to the one meeting.
That's
they'll all be
my
screaming.
Whole thing.
And like, to talk about the... Because every sober woman has food issues.
Yeah, I'm
so
sure.
So to talk about that, you know...
To talk about all of it. Like, just to have... where we really listen to each other. We set goals, and it's like something that's like light and fun, and nobody cares if your kid poops through its clothes throws up on itself. Like not this big, you know, if one of them's screaming, it's like if we could do it at a park or something.
Do it, listener.
I would love
to. If you have a new baby,
yeah, right,
and you're sober,
email me.
Yeah, Alexis here wants to hear from you.
Yeah, if you live in this area, like I was thinking, because so many of my community is in Malibu
yeah.
and Palisades and Santa Monica. Like, if we could all get together at the Malibu Bluffs once a week after your older kids are in school, so like 10 a.m.,
right?
You know. And do it for like an hour and just be committed to it and some, you know, switch
idea.
Off snacks. You know, it's not necessarily like an official 12-step AA meeting because it's open to like, as long as you're in recovery.
Right. It's a great idea.
Come, please.
I can see it. Do you go out to Malibu? How often are you at the... at Acadia.
Okay, well, my husband lives there. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I was like, that's
he pretty much lives there.
Okay.
When we were first dating, he lived there. And I was like, you need to move out of the sober living because I can't date you while you're living here.
Right.
No, it was intense. He's there. Like, that's why I think it works so well, because a lot of these places, like, the owners are never around. They are so hands-on.
Right.
I mean, we have such a different approach than every other treatment center or sober living out there. And it works really well. My husband's there 6 days a week. His business partner's there 6 days a week. They're there all day long and most nights.
Right.
So it's like a home for us. It's like a second home for us.
Your beach house.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's great. And we love it. We just started the farm with on the second property, which is doing really well. We love it. And it's really community. It's really community. One of our executive chef lives with us. He's also in recovery. He got sober at our house.
Right.
And it's really, like, it's a family. They all went to Hurricane Harbor together yesterday. Like, it's this beautiful community where everybody's held accountable. We do women's group and men's group once a week on Tuesday evenings. We have a barbecue that's open to the community and other treatment centers and other sober people on Fridays. It's a huge meeting. It's
every Friday.
Every Friday.
Wow.
6 o'clock is when the barbecue starts, 7 o'clock for the meeting. It's great. We've been getting like 40 to 50 people every week now, sometimes more. And it's a place where you can feel safe about getting honest. Our house manager at the Yellow House is great. She's got 9 years, you know, battled an eating disorder. She's got her master's in psychology and is going to school and works with us full time. And it's just lovely. Like, I feel so lucky to be a part of this community and to see people come in that are so broken, and they normally stay with us for a year. I don't know if that's normal in other sober livings. I don't think it is, but normally they stay with us for like a year. We get them on their feet, get them to jobs, school, like,
and it's
thriving and long-term health and success.
I mean, the number one predictor of, you know, we can't predict who's going to stay sober, but long treatment, you know, treatment for 9 months is, you know, at a minimum is the greatest predictor we have. So, and then what's your arrangement with Vice? Do you write a column for them?
Yeah. So Vice, I did an interview with this
kid,
Mitchell Sutherland. He's great. He's fabulous. And we just kind of stayed in contact because he's like sober too and young, and we just kind of hit it off. And he was like, do you want to write for us every other week for our, you know, Sunday issue? And I was like, yes, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a writer, okay? I'm certainly not a writer.
But they're good.
They're good.
And you kind of get... So you're like, I want to interview Dr. Mate, and then...
Yeah, so I just write.
Yeah.
So I just write Dr. Mate, and I'm like, hey, I'm a new writer. I work for Vice. magazine. Obviously, he knows because he's Canadian and Vice, like, originated in Canada. So he knew who Vice magazine was.
Yeah.
So then he, like, researched me. And, of course, you research me. But it actually, I think that that's kind of what made him want to do it more.
Right.
Because you type it in and not, the first thing that doesn't come up is, like, Vice magazine articles. It's like, Alexis Nyers, heroin addict. Alexis Nyers goes to jail. Alexis Nyers. You know, so he's like, who the hell is this person? And he really did his work. Like,
so what did he come back to you and say?
Well, he was just like, how do you feel about the movie? And Emma Watson's playing you. And like, oh, yeah, you had a troubling past too. And I was like, whoa, how do you know all this?
This was all on the phone or over email? On the phone.
Skype.
Okay, okay.
Skype. We had like, and I was so nervous.
Because he's a genius. Yeah.
I'm just, you just, it's like I said in the article, like, put me to dinner with Kim and Kanye.
Right.
I don't care.
Right.
Put me on a Skype session with Dr. Mente, and I'm like a jittery little girl. Like,
he's
He is cool as a cucumber. Like, is, like, relaxed, at peace, like, totally serene, knows his shit. And, like, I was asking him a lot of questions that obviously he's answered before.
Right.
And so I was like, he's going to be so annoyed. But because being, you know, interviewing someone, especially, you have to get what they say. Like, you can't go, oh, I took it from, you know, you can't take it from anywhere else. So you kind of have to ask the same questions over and over again.
Were you writing it down? I'm just curious, like, as a reporter. So you were tape recording.
I was Skype recording.
Right.
Sent it to an intern. I had to type up the whole thing. I felt bad. But
Yeah, no.
And then you try to, like, condense this 45-minute long interview into this, like, small interview.
Right.
And, you know, I really, that week Corey Monteith had died, I knew right when they said he died. I was like, heroin and alcohol.
How did you know that?
I just had a feeling. Like, people are so uneducated about the fact that, like, if you mix downers together, you'll kill yourself.
Right.
You know, like, if you drink and then pop an Oxy or Vicodin, like, you're risking your heart stopping. Because, you know, it's not like if you mix Coke and alcohol, which tons of people do, because Coke brings you up, the alcohol brings you down. But when you mix that many downers together,
heady sedatives. Yeah, people don't die from Coke that much.
No.
Or meth even, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's mixing these substances, mixing benzos and opiates, mixing opiates and alcohol.
Yeah.
And it's so dangerous. And at first I thought, you know, that weird heroin was going around up there with the fentanyl in it. And people were just dropping like flies. Like, and it happens every couple of months you know, in Vancouver, they have the downtown-y side, which is, like, the greatest population of addicts in the entire world. And it's just, like, this little city and this little part of the city where everybody's addicted to, like, heroin and crack. And they have the safe injection sites.
And that's where Dr. Mente works, right?
He doesn't work there anymore, but he did for, like, 12 years or something like that. Where he treated them, his patients. But yeah, it's just, so every couple of months they'll get the shipments from China of China White, and it'll be so strong and people won't know and they'll just die. Like, people just die on every street corner for a couple of weeks, and then that'll be that. And so I thought, you know, they had this one kind that was like cut with fentanyl, and I thought at first it could be that, but then I was like, no. And I told Mitchell that, and he was like, you're right. And he was like, you need to write about, you know, a little bit about, like, heroin addiction. That's when I thought, I've got to call Dr. Mente because I'm such a big fan.
Right.
And, you know, and I really want to, like, gently educate people through my experience. Like, I don't want to push shit down your throat and tell you what you need to be doing. I used to be like that in early sobriety. I used to be like, you need to do this and you need to do that.
Right.
And I was, like, a Nazi sponsor, and I was crazy, and now it's just, like, it just doesn't work. Cause I don't know what works for everybody. I know what works for me.
Right.
But, like, I've known tons of people that were addicted to heroin and opiates, really dealt with their trauma, and now are able to have a glass of wine once a month and be totally fine, and their life's in order, and they have a job, and it's, like, none of my business.
Yeah, I know. Like, that's a totally hard thing to learn.
It is.
Yeah, because I definitely was, like, very much like, not just alcoholics and addicts need to do this. Everybody needs to do 12 steps. Yes. Like, I was so full on.
We need programs for everyone.
Yeah. These poor people who don't have a problem, so they can't, like, discover the 12 steps. And then it really was a journey to get that, like, yeah that I don't know that, yeah, I know people that could quit their drug of choice and seem to be fine. I don't really know, you know, what's going to shake out. But
I know a lot of them that are like moms now, and they have their shit together and they work and they're doing great. And a lot of them work in recovery. Like, they had abused, I know someone who abused meth for a while, and then, you know, she really dealt with her trauma. Like, trauma is the root of it. Like, she really dealt with it. She got married. She had some kids. Her priorities changed. Like, she became really accountable. She worked with, she did this with a sponsor. Like, told her sponsor, don't think I'm an alcoholic. They worked together. She said, try it, you know, go and try to have a glass of wine. It worked for her. Good for you.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people.
It does not work for.
And I'm not that interested in discovering. I kind of have a theory. I'm not one of those people, and I'm not into doing the research. You know.
Yeah, you know, it's to each his own. The whole thing is just knowing that what works for me doesn't necessarily work for everybody else. You know, like Alexis, it's not Alexis's 12-step program.
Right.
You know, it's just a 12-step program. You know, and like, I am not the queen of AA.
Right.
You know, and that my opinions don't, you know, not everybody wants to hear them.
Yeah.
One thing that I love about my husband is that he's like gentle, kind, loving, compassionate, and he's very spiritual. All of those things are great. But he does not give his opinion or advice unless you ask for it. Which is a very hard thing to do. Even with his sponsees, like, he'll listen and he'll listen. But unless you ask him for his opinion, he's not going to give it to you.
Right.
You know, he's like, I don't know at all.
Yeah.
You know, and what I do know is that... you can really turn people off by trying to, like, force them to agree with you or to do what you say.
Yeah, and it runs them right out of the room.
Yes.
You know? I mean, I'm all about that. I do think that the gentle education is the key factor, because, you know, and that's always been, you know, for a long time, I only would sign off on articles about addiction or books about addiction that were funny, because it's like the medicine goes down a little more smoothly if it's, like, laced in humor. And that was always my agenda, is, like, kind of trick people, make them think you're writing about something, like, hip and cool and funny, and then sort of be giving a message at the same time. I mean, that's the whole theory behind After Party Chat. That's it.
That's great.
But it's... yeah, you get more, whatever the expression, you get more flies with honey or whatever.
Yes.
It's definitely, I think, not being rigid and not being adamant and not be, and just be like, you know, whatever. Showing attraction, not promotion, is a great way that other people have found to talk about it. Okay, wait, so this has been awesome, but we didn't do our game yet.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so the game is just that I have a question about addiction. You have to guess the answer.
Okay.
I'm going to give you three options. Okay. During season one of My Strange Addiction, a woman named Belinda found that her addiction to what got dangerous because it caused her to fall into a, quote, trance-like state, losing her sense of time and throwing caution to the wind. There's still the quote going on. She'll trek through treacherous terrain and wander through dangerous neighborhoods because of this addiction to A, danger.
Okay.
B, meth.
Okay.
C, collecting rocks.
Okay, well, because it's My Strange Addiction, I'd say C, collecting
rocks. Yes, I don't have a D. I know, because that's so insane.
So weird.
It's so insane.
Did you see the one with the guy that loves his car?
I've never... Oh, no, but I heard about that one. I've never seen it.
Or he had a
sexual relationship with his car. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to say anything to get on TV. I'm not going to say any of these people are making this shit up, but it's a little crazy. Okay,
yeah.
Now... really good. You're getting an A so far. Okay, now, who said reality is just a crutch for people who can't handle drugs? Was it A, Charlie Sheen, B, Robin Williams, C, Charles Bukowski?
Well, I'd say A, Charlie Sheen.
That's wrong, and I put him because everybody's always going to guess Charlie Sheen.
Yes, because he would say something like that.
He would totally.
Tiger's blood and winning.
This would be like one of the more normal things for him to say. It was Robin Williams.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's the game.
That was going to be my second.
Okay, good. Good. I'm going to give it to you. But... You know what? I'm going to give you an A-. but like, yeah. No, because you deserve that. Now, okay, and then the question from Twitter was about sex addiction. And okay. It was basically, I think it was just, I apologize to you if you gave this question. You so kindly provided a question for us, and I forgot to write down your name or the exact question, but I just know it was about sex addiction. Thoughts, Alexis, on sex addiction?
Well, it's not killing people like heroin addiction is.
People can't, I think it brought
to certain levels. I don't know. Okay, here's the thing. Is like, I don't know much about sex addiction. I know that Dr. Drew, like, really got on this whole, like, sex addiction thing. And that kind of made it, like, more popular these days. I don't know, because I never was, like, a sex addict.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, to me, it just seems so weird. Like, I don't really know much about it. Like, you have lots of sex with strangers.
Well, I think it's the same thing. I think it's that same, what we've been talking about, that desire to escape, and it manifests itself in...
I had one sponsee that was a sex addict, and I told her you should go to Love Addicts Anonymous.
Yeah, Sex and Love Addicts.
Yes.
And she told you, she said, I know I'm a sex addict? Or just what she described?
I saw she had... certain patterns that were very extreme.
Right.
And I said, you might want to go and check out another meeting. Because I'm just not qualified
right.
to deal with it. I mean, how is it killing people? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that it can be taken. I mean, unprotected sex and...
That's true, but that's more of a health issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's certainly... I'm sure you could die from it. I'll just say that. But I don't...
Anything's possible.
Anything's possible.
You could die from going in a plane.
You could die from walking the street.
Yes.
We could die right now. Like, it could be the big California earthquake.
I don't know much about it. I will say this. If you feel anything that you're doing, any behavior that you're having that is used as a distraction, it can be detrimental in your life.
Yeah.
And it can hurt you. I think that my calling is to help people who have suffered from trauma and who then turn to chemicals.
Yeah.
Initially, that's the biggest thing. I think that you can cross addict to anything. For me, it was like an eating disorder thing. For some people, it may be sex addiction.
Gambling addiction.
I mean, anything can become an addiction. Yeah. Anything that you use in excess that is detrimental to your life is something that you need to take a look at. And there's... Today, there's so many different therapies and so many different 12-step groups. I mean, it's great. So yeah. There's really, like, you have the ability to get help.
Yeah, and if you do think that you have a problem with it, yeah, check out. There's Sex Addicts Anonymous. There's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
So Sex Addicts Anonymous, I feel like, is a little bit extreme because they don't have sex at all, from what I understand. I've never been to a meeting.
I've never been to a meeting. I think maybe, I don't know enough. But, I mean, I say check it out.
Yes. So what I said to my sponsee, who wasn't willing to stop having sex, was you should go to a sex and love
Did she go?
Meeting. I don't know. I just made a suggestion.
She was like, goodbye,
Alexis. No, we still work together. She's great. But
right,
like,
it's not your business.
I made a suggestion.
Right.
And my whole thing is like helping you not have the obsession to drink and use.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think it's important, like you were saying, to help with what you know about.
Yes. I can't say that I know much about. I know a lot about codependency and Al-Anon.
Right,
that could be a part of it too. But,
right.
Sex. That's a tough one. There's just so many different addictions these days.
There are.
Everybody's addicted to something.
I know, and I do think that's true about, like, you know, this generation growing up with that you're being weaned to check out. You're learning to check out from the time your parents put that iPad in front of you when you're three or whatever. And so it's
crazy. You see them at the table, like the dinner table, and they don't want to deal with the 3-year-olds that got an iPad.
Yeah.
How does that teach?
I know.
What does that teach your children? Like, I understand if it's an airplane or something.
Right.
Like, there's certain things that, you know, I'm not like an extremist. Like, no iPods ever.
Right.
But it's like when I was a kid, like, you should go play with your kid. Let them go in nature and ride bikes and get out. Like, I feel like they're always inside playing video games.
Because it's too dangerous out there.
Oh, God, if you're going to fear the world, you're really going to have a really hard life.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to be that afraid of the world, my husband taught me that. Because my mom raised me a lot in fear.
Like, yeah.
Fear everything. Like, she had me in, rape self-defense classes when I was 8. Like everybody, you know, and Evan experienced it with his grandma, putting, 3 inches of water in the bottom of the tub because he was going to drown. If you're going to fear things like that.
Right, right. You're not.
You're just, it's going to be a really tough life for you.
Yeah.
I mean, be safe.
Right, right. It's so interesting, too, because addiction is so, addicts suffer from so much fear. And yet, in general, often are very risk-taking.
Yes.
You know, they suffer from the fear of, what's going to happen when I reveal my true self sitting alone with this person, but not the fear of,
I'm going to go get in my drug dealer's car and be held at gunpoint or, be raped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, okay, this is awesome. I like to end on the word raped. No, but do you have anything else to add? This has been great.
No, it's been great.
Okay.
I'm glad that we did this.
Me too. Okay, stop.